Next, we're going to continue our consideration of Order R3-2017-0002, conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements for discharge from irrigated land. And we did have some additional requests for speaking. And was it Carrie Fisher that we were going to have first, as I recall?
Okay. Correct.
So Ms. Fisher had requested 15 minutes.
Dr. Wolf, before Ms. Fisher starts speaking, I have one small housekeeping matter.
Sure.
There's been some confusion about which parts of the agenda package are part of the order and which are just part of the staff report. The order consists of the order itself, Attachment A, and the three MRPs. The rest of the attachments in the agenda package are attachments to the staff report. I think there's been some confusion about whether Attachment 7, the summary of the anti-DEG analysis, was intended to be part of the order, and it's not. It's part of the staff report. I think part of the confusion is that there's a small typo on page 7 that states that the Central Coast Water Board finds something. That phrase should really be deleted. I think it was a cut-and-paste error.
Okay, thank you.
May I make a comment on that? Another question.
Yes, and thank you for pointing that out, Ms. Sokin. And I also want to comment that in the staff report, attachment A actually has a different attachment number, which I'm trying to find now. Attachment A is actually noted as attachment 2. So there are two names to that document, just so people are clear.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman Wolf and members of the board. My name is Carrie Fisher from the California Farm Bureau Federation. I'm here on behalf of seven county farm bureaus within your region: the Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, Monterey, San Benito, Santa Cruz, Santa Clara, and San Mateo County Farm Bureaus. Unfortunately, none of them were able to join today because at the same time that this is going on, we have a Farm Bureau conference that's going on at the same time, so I'm here on behalf of all of them. We appreciate and support the need for an interim order to provide regulatory coverage to bridge the gap between the expiration of the Ag Order 2.0 and the development of the Ag Order 4.0. However, as currently proposed, the Ag Order 3.0 goes beyond what we were originally told as members of Farm Bureau and other members of agricultural groups. We were originally told that this was going to be a three-year adoption, and while discussions continued on the development of a longer-term agricultural program in order to allow for regulatory orders pending before the state board, as well as court cases to play out. Unfortunately, as currently proposed, Ag Order 3.0 not only contains new provisions, but also new findings that are concerning to our members and will make it more difficult for members and agricultural farmers and ranchers to comply, as well as increase some confusion. So hopefully some of the comments we share today are able to shed some light on potential confusion where we can make some changes. And also, in order to not belabor points that were made by other agricultural groups yesterday, Farm Bureau shares and incorporates by reference many of the comments made by grower shippers of Central California and grower shippers of Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties, both in their respective comment letters and the points made yesterday as well as today. We're going to focus on three different points today, which are the Cooperative Monitoring Program constituent list expansion, the TNA expansion, and some anti-degradation analysis. Excuse me. With regard to the monitoring and reporting program, as the board is aware, Farm Bureau, along with some other groups, petitioned the 2016 changes to the MRP. The arguments within the petition are applicable here as well to the Ag Order 3.0's MRP. And those concerns that we see that were within our petition, as well as being applicable to this MRP, including the monitoring parameters and the monitoring for certain insecticides and for increased monitoring frequencies for these insecticides, the list of additional toxicants and pyrethroid pesticides that need to be monitored, as well as the inclusion of the 6 neonicotinoids, and the lack of the industry standard for the toxicity tests for the neonicotinoids. And discussion was yesterday regarding benchmarks, and we don't want to belabor that point. Another concern we have with the MRP is with regard to the groundwater monitoring reporting requirements, which require discharges to sample groundwater wells that are located within the property border of an enrolled parcel number, regardless of the discharger's control over the groundwater well located on that property. This issue is an actual issue with regard to landlord and tenant legal control. And as you guys know, many of these parcels have tenants that farm these lands, and they do not have control, legal authority to sample any sort of drinking water well for a parcel, a home property that is leased by the landlord. With regard to the response to comments, we're a little concerned with the staff responses, because it just says the tenant should try to sample, and if they can't, contact the regional board, and perhaps a different solution to actually address this issue could be incorporated into Ag Order 3.0 so that the farmer who is a tenant on that land does not face legal issues with the landlord with regard to monitoring some of these wells. Another issue we have is with regard to the monitoring changes and what that leads to increased compliance costs. With just the surface water fees alone being raised by 69%, that doesn't include all of the other sort of monitoring costs that will be increased due to these changes. And these increased compliance costs will affect different farm operators in different tiers in different ways, and will have a disproportionate impact on the smaller farms and some of those members of Tier 2 that will now need additional technical assistance to file the compliance reports and comply with the monitoring provisions. With regard to the total nitrogen applied or the TNA reporting, we echo many of the comments made by Ms. Weinman yesterday with regard to how the proposed Ag Order 3.0 substantially changes how growers must determine if the TNA reporting requirement is reporting is required, as well as expanding the TNA level of reporting and who is subject to the reporting. We do have some concerns with how the Ag Order 3.0 removes the alternative nitrate risk formulas that the State Board specifically incorporated when Ag Order 2.0 was before the State Board. As was discussed yesterday, the increase in TNA reporting will change the number of farms from 600 to about 1,700 farms that must report their TNA. And one point that wasn't made yesterday is that number includes the number of farms, but it doesn't include the number of crops that those farms will be reporting on. So the number of reports that will be required by the growers, as well as the number of reports that the regional board will receive, is a substantially higher number due to just the significant amount of crops that are grown in the Central Coast and the different frequencies of cropping patterns. We also have concerns with the value of the data that's reported. In comments yesterday, there was some discussion regarding requiring ratios by the regional board, and that is a very concerning comment or concerning issue, as well as inappropriate. We think for the regional board to pursuing at this point in time. The TNA, by its very nature, does not capture the entire picture of what's going on the farm or what's going on with regard to nitrogen that's applied to the farm. factors that can affect the nitrogen concentration in harvested plants are many. Just for example, it depends on the year of harvest, the nitrogen available, the fruit size, the dry matter content of the harvested plant, the marketable yield, the growth stage, the amount of harvested versus unharvested material, the soil type, the planting type, the weather, the microclimates, and the list goes on and on. So total nitrogen applied is just a very small portion of the entire picture. As you guys are probably well aware, the Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board is also looking into the issue of nitrogen reporting, and although their current approach is somewhat different than what is before the board in Ag Order 3.0, the issues that they're facing are similar issues to what you guys are facing right now. Recently, the coalitions under the Central Valley region contracted with UC Cooperative Extension to do a literature review of the nitrogen concentrations in harvested plants that are grown within the Central Valley area. And that study is definitely something that's important for also the Central Coast, because what that study showed us is that there's a lot of information that is not known with regard to nitrogen applied and nitrogen removed ratios, nitrogen concentrations for different crops, it depends on so many different factors that there's either lack of information for California crops, or that information that we do have is 50 plus years old, and that information does not actually reflect the cropping patterns and the cropping practices that are used right now. So there's a lot of information that still needs to be grown with information that still needs to be known to better inform the use of total nitrogen applied and just nitrogen information coming from the farm field. We also have concerns with the reporting period for the total nitrogen applied. Ag Order 3.0 requires growers to report the TNA for the preceding calendar year. Although the first reporting period will be March 2018, it will require growers to report from January 1st, 2017 to December 31st, 2017. And this is concerning for us because there is a gap where this ag order will retroactively apply to a period of time in which the ag order is not an official board order. And so that is concerning for us because with the expansion of who will need to report under the TNA and the vast number of farms and crops, it will require growers to have already gathered all that information for the TNA report. And there are concerns that growers might not have reported or recorded in the form that they will need for the TNA report, as their management practices for reporting might have been different. And so there's a definite gap, and therefore the first year of TNA reports might be extremely skewed and not be useful for the regional board to do any sort of comparisons. The final topic that I'd like to talk about today is with regard to the anti-degradation policy. And we have concerns with Ag Order 3.0's anti-degradation analysis. First off, we would suggest that the anti-degradation analysis separate groundwater and surface water rather than lumping them together, and do an independent anti-degradation analysis on groundwater and surface water, especially with regard to the best practical treatment and control analysis, since BPTC for groundwater is vastly different than for surface water. With regard to findings 22 through 30 in the anti-degradation analysis section, we have some overall comments regarding the bias against agriculture that is found in those comments. We also have concerns with regard to how it ignores Water Code Section 13000 regarding the regulation of water quality to the highest degree that is reasonable. There is a response to comments made by staff that attempts to give little weight to this section of the water code, calling for reasonableness. We would just like to point out that that is not the only section within the water code that calls for reasonableness. Not only is the guiding principle of water regulation in California reasonableness, but Porter Cologne expressly calls for reasonableness and reasonable actions throughout. Just to name a few other sections of the water code that require this is Water Code 13241, Water Code 13050H, Water Code 13263, and Water Code 13267B1. Additionally, there is case law that specifically the City of Burbank versus State Water Resources Control Board that says that the anti-degradation policy reflects the legislature's intent to attain the highest water quality that is reasonable in light of important economic, social, and other water quality factors. Further, the Central Coast Regional Board's Basin Plan calls for programs to achieve the reasonable protection of beneficial uses. And finally, the anti-degradation policy itself is pragmatic in recognizing that social and economic concerns may sometimes outweigh the interest in maximizing existing high-quality waters. These are just a few areas to point out that the need for reasonableness and reviewing this in a reasonable manner is throughout the Water Code and other different policies before the State Board, Regional Board. With regard to finding 27 that deals with best practical treatment and control, attachment 7, which we are aware that is an attachment to the staff report, it does state that Ag Order 4.0 will bring discharges into compliance with the requirements of BPTC. We would like to point out that this statement ignores the current Ag Order 2.0 as well as the proposed Ag Order 3.0's existing BPTC requirements, and we would recommend that the Regional Board change this finding in order to reflect that proposed Order 3 or proposed Order 3.0 does reflect best practical treatment control, and that the order does it does meet best practical and treatment control requirements with regard to the management practices and the feedback mechanisms which compel BPTC. Also, it should be noted that BPTC is fluid as a breast management practices, which the basin plan equates to BPTC, will change over time. And what is a BPTC now will likely be changed by the time that Ag Order 4.0 is before the board.
Thank you. So I'm going to start with my right. Dr. Hunter.
I thank you for your comments. And I am, in particular, I wanted to acknowledge that any work that can be done to increase data in terms of, I'm looking for my notes here, sorry for a moment, in terms of looking at any gaps in our understanding of assessing the issue with nitrogen and the balance between application and what is harvested and what remains. So that is good news, and I think we all agree that that's the direction we need to go in. We need to take every approach and technology and knowledge, expertise, et cetera. And I think the Farm Bureau has always been a leader in establishing that level of high-quality research. So that is very good news indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you. My second question is to staff, and but it has to do with your remarks concerning the increase in cost, and you mentioned in particular 69%. And I know that numbers need to be parsed. And in this case, I am aware, and I did review in the staff report some different comments that came from staff in helping us to understand what that 69% number incorporates. That is a real number. However, when you look at the context in which that 69% is calculated, we actually understand that the increase in cost is probably a lot less than that. So when staff makes their comments collectively at the end, if Chris, if you could include that. I know that it came up in response to public comments in several of the letters, as it was a consistent comment across several. So we have in the record already these numbers, right. But I'd like to clarify it.
And I did see the response to comments that did comment that the 69% only referred to an increase in laboratory costs, and I asked CMP if that was the case and was told that no, that it did not refer just to laboratory costs, but there is an issue with reserve funds and things like that, so I'm sure that they can be the ones that can give you a true picture of everything that goes into their costs for growers, but from our knowledge, we were told it was not just limited to laboratory fees that were going up.
Yeah, and I think on my part, my interest is in helping to highlight or increase transparency so that the growers themselves understand the different numbers and how they reflect on actual projected costs increase. Because that is a big number. And if that's the only number that is in the dialogue amongst the growers and their organizations, I think that's misleading, and I think we need to have some context there so that we're not creating, you know, a level of concern and fear and et cetera that could be perhaps damped down a bit. And looking at realistically where those cost increases are occurring and how they reflect based on where they are now. So that would be my intent. So that's it for me. Thank you. Thank you.
So I'll move on my left. I'll start with Mr. Young, and I'll move down.
Hi, Ms. Fisher. We haven't seen you here in a few years. Welcome back.
Thanks. I had to take some time off and have some kids, and now I'm back.
Congratulations. Couple of things I just wanted to explore with you.
Sure.
On the TNA.
Yes.
What's Farm Bureau's position with respect to any kind of a metric to be used for trying to put some limits on how much nitrogen gets applied? Yeah, instead of us having kind of a general narrative thing, I mean, it looks like we're heading towards something that's kind of, you know, enforceable, that's a little more black and white.
I think Mr. Zielinski had some good comments yesterday with regard to what needs to be done and educating growers to try to get proper application of nitrates in those situations that perhaps growers, for various reasons, are applying more than is needed or is able to be utilized. With regard to a strict ratio, that is not something Farm Bureau supports. There's so many different factors, as I just alluded a little bit to, that goes into how much you apply and what's taken up and what is in the soil and various other issues that just a strict, hard number to meet is very difficult and doesn't properly show necessarily who is a good actor versus a bad actor.
And, you know, I appreciate that, and I took extensive notes yesterday from what he was saying, and I asked him some follow-up questions. I can't say I was, you know, persuaded by what he said, because it seemed to be kind of generalized, a little too generalized. And so I'm not suggesting, you know, that there's a hard and fast ratio that gets applied across the board, but what if it looked like a range depending on, you know, crop types? Is that something that Farm Bureau would be receptive to?
I couldn't agree to anything like that at this time. Just even meeting a range is very difficult. Even the expert panel did have some comments on specific numbers and how you need to average or over multiple years in order to adequately reflect the entire situation that's going on. And Farm Bureau even has some concerns with what the expert panel put out. So it's really hard for me to come up here and tell you I'm able to endorse anything like that at this time.
I understand. And it is complex. I mean, I would agree with you. There's a lot of factors that would affect what the plants take up.
Mm-hmm.
What is left in the ground, what becomes available, and what passes down through the soil. I mean, it's not an easy thing to kind of, you know, calculate, determine. Your suggestions on, you know, the reasonable use.
Mm-hmm.
Is it your position that a discharge could be reasonable while at the same time is contributing to an exceedance of a water quality standard?
I believe that the regional board could do an anti-degradation analysis in which looking at the entire picture with including reasonableness as well as the maximum benefit to the people that would allow a certain degradation to waters while still complying with anti-deg and being within the maximum benefit of the people. With regard to the maximum benefit analysis within the current proposed orders anti-degradation analysis section, we feel that it doesn't fully capture the entire picture going on in the Central Coast and leaves off the maximum benefit to the people with regard to the importance of agriculture, its food source, safe and stable food support source, as well as the benefits to the economy. And it just looks at the benefit or not to water quality. And I think the spirit of the reasonableness comments were with regard to needing to look at the entire picture and not just focus on one segment of that analysis.
You know, I appreciate that. And there was a comment made yesterday about, you know, profits, you know, ag just pursuing profits, you know, at the expense of, you know, water quality. And I don't think that truly paints the picture, you know, of what's going on in the broad social context. I mean, we need clean water to drink, but then right after that is that we need food to eat. And there's probably nothing more important than, you know, fruits and vegetables. I mean, farmers are not growing Cheetos or things like that, you know. You are, Perry? Cheetos, well. But my point is they are doing something that has huge social benefit across the board. And it really, you know, does play into this discussion of, you know, reasonableness. But I'm really trying to pull you to, you know, what concerns me is how does that really apply and can contrast against a water quality standard, which is kind of pretty black and white.
Right.
And can, I mean, what really is the maximum, you know, benefit? Is it just the food production itself and the employment of thousands of people, which is hugely beneficial, but then the degradation, you know, of water quality?
It's a difficult topic, and it's something that Farm Bureau members and myself, we continue to grapple with because we're not out there trying to negatively impact people's water source, and clean water is definitely an issue that we focus on as well. And so it's a balancing issue, and that's part of the anti-degradation analysis that is before the board is balancing all of that in order to weigh all these factors to have a proper program that allows agriculture to continue to thrive on the Central Coast.
You know, my concern is with where that might lead is then what is reasonable degradation, you know, in kind of a balancing of these competing interests. You know, how much degradation is acceptable, you know, once you have a standard that is being exceeded. I mean, is there any limit to it?
I think you guys have, excuse me, within your basin plan and your water quality standards that you have, you do have to comply with the law when doing an anti-degradation analysis. So I don't see it as something that's just vastly open before the board and you won't have any parameters that you have to comply with. So a balancing, you do have parameters when you're making that balancing analysis.
Just as a reminder, we have a court reporter here, and we need to make sure we all slow down, you know, as we speak. So that applies to all of us. Thank you.
I appreciate the discussion because I don't get to talk to you and others, you know, that represent Farm Bureau on things like this, and I like to kind of explore as much as you're able to share with me, you know, what these parameters look like that I see as heading down at some point to kind of get resolved. So thank you.
Good morning, Ms. Fisher. Thank you for coming. I'm familiar with Carrie Fisher at the Santa Barbara County Farm Bureau, so had a different vision in my head, but it's nice to see you as well. Thank you. So I just have one question related to what the Farm Bureau's position is on well monitoring. You made some statements about, understanding that...
Ms. Gray, this applies to you too.
Sorry. I'm from New York. That's how we speak. I will slow down. Sorry. So related to the well monitoring for tenants, you brought up the issue of legal entanglement. So understanding that we have to have this information, what are your suggestions?
I don't have a formal proposal before you to perhaps remedy that issue, but with regard to the requirement, we just have concerns over if a farmer that is on the land is not able to, the landlord has told them you cannot contact the residents in that property. That's a pretty black and white issue with regard to the farmer will not be able to test that well. And so then it becomes, is it out to the regional board in which the farmer can say, we don't have legal authority to do that. You know, regional board, you're going to have to contact the landowner and have them do it. It's just wanting to see where the responsibility lies when the farmer is not able to do that. I was wanting to see if we can parse out staff's response and the response to comments, which just says, farmer, if you can't do it, contact us. Well, is that really the procedure that you want to do? Is that going to protect the farmer who isn't able to, they're not trying to not comply with the ag order, they just legally cannot monitor that well, and what would be the procedures for the board in order to make sure that the farmer is not deemed to be in noncompliance with the order?
So are we getting staff response now, or is it just speakers? So do we have a response from staff?
I was going to say the way we were working this yesterday was we would finish questions to the individual speaker, and then we'll circle
all the
back
questions
to staff.
Right now are directly with a speaker.
Ms. Fisher, okay.
And then we have staff record all, you know, all their response, and they will provide them as, you know, one aggregated entity. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mayor Delgado?
Yes.
Good morning.
I appreciate that you sent your letter in, I think it was January 6th, 2017, and some of your spoken concerns today marry up to those concerns you expressed in your letter. But one concern you discussed today that I didn't see in your letter was about the best practices, treatment, and controls missing from the findings and that there are currently management actions that growers are taking that you believe should be considered as BPTCs and that, unfortunately, in your opinion, they're not in the findings. There was a comment by Abby Taylor Silva. Did I get that right? I always can get confused if it's Silva Taylor or Taylor Silva. But anyway, that saying the same thing in her letter. And there was a response to that from our staff saying, please see anti-DEG findings 22 to 29. Have you looked at those findings 22 to 29? So at least among those, 27 talks about integrated pest management, good housekeeping requirements, controlling waste, pesticide management, farm plans. Do you think education and planning that the growers are doing, do you think that that's an insufficient list of BPTCs? Did you have other things in mind that we're missing?
I believe it can be more specific. Would you like me to read them to you? For tiers 1, 2, and 3, I think the list could include as follows: installation of backflow prevention devices, proper well abandonment practices, proper maintenance of containment structures, proper handling of pesticide and fertilizers, erosion control practices, maintenance of riparian vegetative cover and riparian areas, protection of aquatic habitat, preparation of a farm plan, receiving water monitoring, groundwater monitoring, drinking water monitoring, and notification. For tiers 2 and 3, the addition would be annual compliance reporting to the regional board, reporting of total nitrogen applied to fields. For tier 3, the inclusion for that tier would be individual surface water discharge monitoring, preparation and implementation of an irrigation and nutrient management plan certified by a professional surface water discharge, or certified by a professional, surface water discharge monitoring, preparation and implementation of a water quality buffer plan, and further, the modified order contains a schedule for compliance with implementation of the required management practices and monitoring and reporting with clear, firm deadlines.
Thank you very much. That was like staff when they have additional slides that they bring in at the end. So that was great. That's exactly what I was hoping for. The expert panel in its final report discusses AR ratios as being a primary metric to try to solve this overapplication of nitrogen.
Mm-hmm.
What's your take on the expert panel's address of the AR ratio?
We believe the AR ratio is a definite useful tool for growers. As the expert panel put forth, the AR ratio should be aggregated over a 3-year period of time in order to try to capture anomalies that happen within the cropping pattern or the weather and things like that. Do we believe that 3 years is adequate? That's open for discussion. Perhaps it should be more years, but we definitely see that it can be a tool for growers to see not only how much nitrogen applied and removed is on their crop, but with how the Central Valley Board is using it, it also allows growers to be compared to other growers with that same crop, so they see exactly where they are in order to for the regional board and the coalitions to start trying to see why there are vast differences. And so it can be a very useful educational tool.
Okay, thank you. And I agree with you that more information is needed about total nitrogen applied and what we do with that information and how much we can regulate using that information, especially in isolation of any other information, which I hope we never do. Do you agree that the Water Board and our staff's focus on collecting nitrogen applied information to create the kind of graphs we saw yesterday on slides 16 and 17 and 21, do you agree that that has helped us along the path of understanding TNA and how it plays a role in getting at the solutions?
I believe it's definitely a step because, as we talked earlier, it can be used as an educational tool. Well, necessarily should it be reported to the board or be used as a reporting tool. That's not necessarily something that Farm Bureau supports at this time. Is it the current, the best manner for growers to be reporting? I think you heard yesterday that various growers report in different manners, and so it becomes a little complicated. Was the histogram the best way to put the information together? I don't know. It was a little confusing, I think, for various folks with regard to the residual. And so I think there's potentially other ways as well that information could come to the board or information could be gathered by growers for educational purposes. So,
okay. All right. Thank you very much, Carrie.
Mr. Jones?
Thank you, Dr. Wolf. So, Ms. Fisher, you raise a on behalf of the Farm Bureau a large number of substantial critiques of Ag Waiver 3.0 in its current form. And I also note that in your letter, you objected to the fact that changes were made in the 2016 MRP without opportunity for further public comment and rebuttable testimony. So I have to assume that if we were to make any one of a number of the kinds of changes that would be required to be responsive to the concerns you're raising, that it would require a new comment period and would not allow an order to be passed this week. Do you concur with that?
I don't believe that all of the changes would need a notice and comment period, especially with regard to anti-degradation.
Okay, leaving anti-degradation aside for a minute, you're proposing some much larger changes, such as not eliminating the monitoring for neonicotinoids and pyrethroids, such as rolling back the proposed expansion from 400 to, I believe, it's 1,700 farms required to do the nitrogen reports. Would those sorts of changes require a delay in moving forward on a plan, in your opinion?
No, I believe that's something that you as the board have the ability to change. It's everything that is currently before the board and comments that I made are current changes, and you have the ability to, let's say you wanted from 600 to 800. That's within your discretion to change the number or keep it the same.
Without any further comment period or rebuttable testimony. Well, I'll ask staff to, or I'll ask council to comment on that as well.
I'm sorry, I was talking to Tammy and I didn't hear the question.
Oh, the question was, were we to make changes like eliminating the monitoring for neonicotinoids and pyrethroids or rolling back the proposal to expand the nitrogen application reports from 400 to 1,700 farms, would that require a further comment period?
No, it wouldn't. Those were proposed changes in this order, and they were subject to comment, and the changes that you're discussing would be in response to comments.
Okay, thank you. I guess my other question is this, Ms. Fisher. You raise a lot of, I think, pretty legitimate questions about the certainty of data, the ability to understand with precision, and develop with precision a metric that's going to predict for every farm with every soil type and with climate variability and everything else, timing, fate of nitrate. And that's easy to do, frankly. Almost anything we put up here can have holes poked in it by advocates for any one of the multitude of sides that of stakeholders that are out there. Putting yourself for the moment in our shoes as a board, it's pretty clearly established that in our region, which is 82% dependent on groundwater for drinking water, that there is an immense and growing nitrate pollution problem, that the principal cause of that is irrigated agriculture, application of nitrogen that goes below the root zone, and that if we were able to wave a magic wand and stop that tomorrow, which nobody in this room thinks we can, it would still take 50 to 100 years, and it may be optimistic, for the various aquifers to be below the MCLs for safe drinking water. And that, in fact, even if we were able to wave that magic wand, we would see continued deterioration because of what's already in transit in those aquifers. So in that situation, yeah, I understand that it's easy to poke holes in almost any metric we come up with, but what would the Farm Bureau say is a reasonable means for us as a regulatory agency to stop digging here, to stop the problem from getting worse?
I don't think there's any easy answer to that right now, as you eloquently
bummer.
Discussed the large issue that's before the board and what's facing this region. There are educational opportunities, as was talked about with staff just yesterday. Whether nitrogen can be utilized in irrigation water was kind of an unknown until just a year or two ago. And so there is a lot of information that's coming out that now needs to be transmitted to growers to make sure that they are accounting for all of this issue, all of these different issues in the science that is coming out, so that they can use this as an educational opportunity. And it's just a little premature for me to conclude what is the best or what is the best manner for growers to utilize all this information.
Do you think that we would be fulfilling our legal regulatory obligations as under state and federal law if our program consisted simply of educating farmers?
That's not just what I'm advocating for. I think there's many components of the Ag Order 3.0 that require monitoring and reporting, as well as feedback mechanisms and verification provisions. So I'm just talking about one component of the nitrogen. Mm-hmm.
I guess my question is, where do we go? I mean, actually, Mr. Zielinski was talking about ratios as a tool we ought to be using. Where does the Farm Bureau think we should go in terms of actually taking regulatory steps to make this to stop this problem from getting worse, so that we can start turning the ship around? Because it's helpful to hear your critiques of what we're proposing. It would be more helpful to hear what you think we ought to do that would actually solve the problem.
I don't think anything I can propose right now will help you solve the problem for this current ag order. It's not before your board. It's not something you could adopt anyway, even if I had this grand idea. I think this is a discussion that definitely needs to concur with the development of Ag Order 4.0, utilizing what the state board is deciding within their East San Joaquin order, as well as what the Central Valley Board is currently doing with regard to their nitrogen ratios, and utilizing the education that can come from growers just gathering and internally reporting their nitrogen information. It may be useful also for this board to hear how the Central Valley coalitions are utilizing the grower information with regard to nitrogen applied and nitrogen removed, and how they then turn that data around and give it back to their growers so those growers can improve their management practices. Just as a different option for this board as well.
Thank you.
So thank you, and you know, I've attended four of our workshops that were held by Mr. Chris Rose, and in these workshops were the presence of growers themselves, and you know, there was a lot of dialogue taking place, and it seems that some of the concerns expressed today are not wholly reflective of individual concerns shared by growers, and perhaps because not everybody is comfortable to raise their hand and say, you know, your water board, you,
you folks get it all wrong. So that's a possibility that, you know, you're in a different position in being able to reflect the communal viewpoints. But I'm going to ask an unusual question, and it's basically a 30,000-foot elevation question. Is there anything in 3.0 that you like?
I didn't attack the whole 3.0.
Well, I didn't use the word attack because, you know, basically the request is no change from 2.0. That was your introductory comments.
It was more of an opening comment that's what we had been told, and so then to get a document that didn't reflect that was of concern.
Because I think there had been some giving and taking, I would say reflecting on the process of 3.0 versus 2.0. And I always look at the positive of things. I think the process of 3.0 had a much, much more robust engagement with the stakeholders. And I was on the board on 2.0. Yes, I was not here. I was on this other side. But I witnessed it. So, you know, a lot of efforts have been made, to engage a little bit more. So I feel that, for example, in the area of pesticide monitoring, you know, yes, there's been some additions, but there has been some deletion also, where the board did a little bit of value engineering saying, is it really worth keeping on monitoring, you know, certain constituents when it's really not an issue? And we removed it. So, and that was in part to help also offset the overall cost of the monitoring.
And I believe that our comments were that we had concerns over that, and is there opportunity or availability for the board to perhaps change the frequency of the monitoring? And that was a comment that we had raised, and I believe that our next speaker with Grower Shipper will possibly address that, and that's something that we're open to. So we're not standing up here saying we disagree with the frequency, and that's period. You know, we're not ready to discuss other alternatives, and it's just an issue that we're raising because it was an issue that my members had raised to me, and is there availability, opportunity for perhaps other changes in the frequency in the years that is monitored? Yes, and that's something I will defer to the comments after me.
Because I also refer back to a summary table which showed 3.0 draft. Mm-hmm. And then 3.0 with revisions, and there were, you know, definitely some change that staff agreed to make, and I assume that was stemmed from dialogue that I had with, farmer representative groups.
Yes,
like yourself.
Definitely, and my members have passed on to me that they are very appreciative of working with Mr. Rose and other members of your staff in all of those communications, and it has been a much different process than Ag Order 2.0, as you said, and they're very happy to have had that dialogue and those changes reflected in Ag Order 3.0.
I appreciate that because, you know, I'm one always look at the glass is half full rather than half empty. Actually, my wife sometimes says, no, you always look at the glass is three-quarter full because I tend to be more of a positive thinker.
And also, I would just say that our comments with the anti-degradation policy are set in the light of opportunity for the board to perhaps make some changes. And it's not asking to throw anything out or anything like that. It's an opportunity for your analysis to perhaps be revised.
Mm-hmm. So one item that you brought up and puzzled me a little bit is in the concerns about the well testing, mm-hmm. and having a tenant on the property, and basically having the land owner, you know, objecting to a tenant perform testing. And I have a pretty reasonably good peripheral view of the farmers community. Because of some of my own other activities. And I just can't I cannot imagine an owner who would be willing to take on the huge liability of saying, you're not going to test these wells and these water. I won't let you do that. Because if anything happened to this tenant, I mean, this tenant would have a significant legal right to say, you know, you provided me contaminated water, and here's my medical bill, and by the way, talk to my attorney. So I hear your comment, but I'm thinking now, putting the theory aside, or the legal theory aside, of, you know, access and trespassing right, et cetera. But I just can't see the common sense liability, because you know very well farmers already have a lot of legal exposure, and legal exposure limitation here is not to ignore, you know, a big potential issue. So I heard your comment on that, but frankly, I don't, it may be, you know, I don't know who would think that way. And, you know, you also know, and you know, farmers are well informed about the human right to safe drinking water. I mean, this is pretty well published, and I know Farnborough, in some of its literature, even, you know, has had in your newsletter some comments on that. So I heard you, but I'm puzzled.
It's an issue that our members have commented on, the difficulty not only within the Central Coast but also in the Central Valley, and so that's passing that on is an issue that has been seen. And so just trying to figure out other manners or some language that can be inserted in the order to address that issue.
Okay. And then before I, you know, I have some questions, but I'm sure they will be answered by staff because they relate to the various comments you had. But, you know, lastly also, you know, I wanted to mention that with 3.0 versus 2.0, staff has had very close communication with DPR and with CDFA. So I'm assuming that likewise, you know, as Farm Bureau, you have close communication with DPR mm-hmm. and CDFA. So in the conversation you had, has there been any comment that you know associated with our proposed 3.0?
I have not had any conversations with either one of those agencies on this specific ag order, no.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. And so right now I would like to have staff respond to both inquiries made by my colleagues but also by Ms. Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Wolf. This is Christopher Rose of the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program. I will begin with responding to Dr. Hunter's question with respect to the cost. The 69% increase in the lab costs comes from dialogue that staff has had with Preservation, Inc., as well as some documentation that we received from Preservation, Inc., in which the percent increase was estimated based on Ag Order 2.0 laboratory costs. And within the documentation itself, it stated that this is calculated off of laboratory costs. All right. Preservation, Inc. Submits invoices or gives invoices to growers, and those invoices include things like the administration fee for Preservation, Inc. They have an administration fee, which, of course, should not be impacted by any changes that we are making or that we're proposing to the MRPs because it's not related. And that invoice is also included the state permit fee. So when the grower enrolls in the order, they have to pay a permit fee to the State Water Board, and rather than paying that fee directly to the State Water Board, they pay that fee to Preservation, Inc., and it is really Preservation, Inc. who is handling that on behalf of the grower and then submits that permit fee to the State Water Resources Control Board. By being a member of Preservation Inc. and the Cooperative Monitoring Program, the grower receives a significant cost reduction in that permit fee. So, for example, an average 150-acre ranch, for example, without being enrolled in the Cooperative Monitoring Program, would pay about $3,200 for that fee. But by virtue of the fact that they're enrolled in the monitoring program and the monitoring program is doing the monitoring on their behalf, that fee is about $700. So some of the cost is really taken up by the fact that they have this reduction in the permit fee. As Dr. Wolf mentioned, what we tried to do is we also tried to remove constituents from the proposed MRPs to offset some of the increase in the costs. And then finally, even if that 69% is something other than the lab fee, which we can't imagine how it possibly could be because, again, Preservation Inc. and the Cooperative Monitoring Program, they're going to these monitoring sites and they're taking samples. And the increase in the monitoring that we are proposing in the monitoring reporting programs for Ag Order 3.0 does not increase the frequency of how many times they go out in the field. It simply says when you pull that sample, we also want you to analyze for these new analytes. All right. But even given that, we believe that the cost of that increased cost is reasonable in light of the benefit. And we say that because, as we talked yesterday, the increase in the pesticide use of the neonicotinoids and also the pyrethroid pesticides and the toxicity that we've seen from them, we need to address this. And it's part of the goals of this order is to address that toxicity.
Thank you for clarifying how the 69%, where that 69% number falls. But I also remember, and I'm sorry about, I cannot locate it in the document in the response to comments, but I also remember there were some other comparisons between 2014 and 2015 and how some costs were reduced between 2014 and 2015. And then, so comparing, if you looked at across the 3 years, that 69% actually doesn't reflect where
right.
They started with the 2012 2.0, right? So over time. So that was another part of it that I was trying to understand.
Exactly, yes. So that 69% increase in the laboratory costs is compared to the least expensive year in the monitoring that occurred during Ag Order 2.0. When you compare the cost increase as a result of the increased monitoring for the neonicotinoids and toxicity to the most expensive year in Ag Order 2.0, then that increase is about 9%.
That's what I was trying to
right.
remember because that is such a tremendous difference.
Yeah.
So, and I realize that numbers are complicated and carry all these variables with them, but if you are thinking about the cost over time and the high point, wherever those spikes are, and you look at where we're headed now, you know, it's clearly a smaller number than 69%. I'm not sure that 9% is accurate either, but I would, you know, a reasonable person would say, okay, we've absorbed higher costs at different times, so this one is going to be a spike. We don't know where lab costs will go once they have the protocols established, more labs are offering it, gets competitive, and hopefully those costs will come down. But I just wanted, I wanted to understand that 9% number. That's where I was going. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you. And then with respect to some of the other dialogue that occurred with...
Ms. Cervantes had a...
Yeah, I just had a clarification question based on what you just said in terms of the costs with those peak years. What were those high costs associated with? And then the other piece of it is the reduction in costs. Was that a result of streamlining some of the process, whether it was some of the reporting requirements?
Sure. Thank you. In Ag Order 2.0, Preservation, Inc., and the Cooperative Monitoring Program for Preservation, Inc. They also monitored for other pesticides. They monitored for pesticides, and they also did toxicity analyses. And that cost was spread out over a couple of different years. So in some years, they had higher costs because they were doing toxicity monitoring and they were doing pesticide analyses. However, in later years, during Ag Order 2.0, that analysis was finished. So it's not that they were streamlining, except that the monitoring reporting programs did not require that they do that more expensive analysis. And I should mention that the pesticide and the toxicity analysis are very expensive, and they have 50 sites, so it adds up fast. So that is why those most expensive years, that is when they were doing the pesticide analysis and the toxicity analysis. In that last year, 2014, they didn't have to do that. The costs were down. And then with respect to some of the other dialogue with Ms. Fisher, there's a lot going on. I wanted to echo the dialogue that the total nitrogen applied reporting and the histograms that staff has been using to illustrate the nitrogen applied compared to the nitrogen take up by those crops. As Ms. Fisher said, it is an educational tool. It's an educational tool, again, not only for growers, but the educators for growers, and not only in Ag Order 2.0, but 3.0 and probably 4.0 as well. It's going to be something that we're going to need through the years in order to make progress. And with that, I think I will move on and let Ms. Schroeder then respond to the drinking water the drinking water well requirements.
Thanks. Angela Schroeder, Regional Board Section Manager. So I appreciate Ms. Fisher bringing up this issue again about landowners and operators. And just a reminder to the board, and I know that we're all fully aware of this, but the order does define dischargers as both landowners and operators. So the requirements do apply to them both. And we recognize that good coordination between landowners and operators is essential to the compliance with these requirements. And in general, operators have sufficient control to implement those requirements. And actually, for the groundwater monitoring requirements, we have had, we have had over 4,000 wells sampled, and in generally without any issue. There have been situations brought to our attention, and I'll say I can count them on less than one hand. Maybe four or five have come up where a tenant or an operator will contact us and say, the landowner is refusing access. What we have found, and this is based upon just our follow-up phone calls with the landowners, there is a fundamental misunderstanding that these requirements are in fact true, that they do have to comply, and we can normally just forward them the link to the order and resolve those issues. I would say in maybe two or three situations, the landowner has been very reluctant, and so we've issued a letter formally to them saying you have to provide access or conduct this monitoring on your own, and the wells have been sampled in that fashion. And this has been, these very few cases have been both individual growers as well as members of the Central Coast Groundwater Coalition. So we've had, the opportunity to have those conversations in both those realms, and I have no concerns about this issue. There's very few, and they've all been resolved.
So, Angela, if I could just go over the numbers there. So you said there were four or five instances where we had what seems like maybe a misunderstanding between grower and landowner?
That's correct.
And there's about 4,000 wells that were sampled. So that's, my weak math, that's less than 1% we're talking about.
That's correct.
Any other questions from the board for us?
You did not respond to the comment made by Ms. Fisher in regard to the number of farms versus number of crops. We talked about increasing to 1,700 reports. Remember, that was a comment she made. So could you respond to that?
Yes. So the proposed total nitrogen applied reporting expansion would go from 600 farms to approximately 1,700 farms. The number of crops that would be reported would, it's hard to say the number of crops that would be reported from that expansion. However, as you saw on the graphs yesterday, over 90% of the crops fall within, I think it was like eight crops, and we anticipate that pattern will continue, because again, we are still talking about vegetable farmers, essentially tier two and tier three vegetable farmers, who are by and large, most of them are growing things like lettuce, broccoli, spinach, celery, onions, and things like that. So we don't anticipate that the number of crops is going to increase, but again, the number of ranches that will be required to report will increase.
Chris, if I understand it, I think the point that Ms. Fisher was trying to make is just that the volume and sort of a data volume question and the ability to handle that much data with the diversity of crops and the expansion of the number of ranches reporting. And can you speak to staff's ability to handle sort of that throughput of additional data and information?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Robertson. Yes, we believe that we can handle this additional volume of data. As we were talking yesterday, behind the total nitrogen applied form, which looks like a PDF form that you can fill in, is the capacity for staff to take that form and just simply bring it into a spreadsheet and then into a database format. It would just simply be a function of the work would simply be a function of bringing more forms into the spreadsheet, which has been automated. So can staff handle this additional volume? Yes, we can.
Okay. Because I have one more question, so go ahead.
Yeah, and the key word here is automated, and I'm not sure people understand what that means, but so for my understanding, that means that form is designed to auto-populate a spreadsheet so that the information goes into the correct column and the correct row and so forth. So those numbers are automatically being calculated within the design of the spreadsheet.
That is correct. They are not being hand-entered.
Right. Okay, good.
And I think on the same topic, Mr. Young had a question, and I think Mayor Delgado too. So, Mr. Young.
Thank you, Dr. Wolf. So, Chris, let's ask the question this way. So the histograms were displaying 600 ranches of data?
Yes.
Okay. How many crops were reported from those 600 ranches? Then we could just look at this proportionally maybe to get an idea.
Could you? This is Arwen Wyatt, mayor of our staff, a water resource control engineer who is one of the people responsible for the total nitrogen applied reporting requirement.
So in those 600 ranches that we receive reports for, we've received about 2,000 individual crop records each year. So I would expect the expansion would be on the same scale.
So the expansion would be probably proportional?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So I thought that Ms. Fisher's comments were related to not whether our staff could handle the increased load, but it was a comment more towards the increased load requirement on the farmers. Robertson, did you pick that up? Is that right, Ms. Fisher? You could just nod from where you're at. Well, then you'd have to come up here to...
Carrie Fisher, it was to both the requirements expansion, not only to the growers themselves filling them out, but then that's transferred over to the board as well.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. I'll save my question, my next question for.
Okay. Mayor Delgado, on the same topic.
But on Carrie Fisher's comments and questions to staff.
Okay. So let me then, because we are on this particular topic, I was going to then continue my last question, and then, you know, certainly, you know, then you can bring up your other question. The other one item that, and by the way, the math is 5,660
records
that you will get. All right? So get ready.
We can do it.
So you didn't comment on Ms. Fisher input in regard to the reporting period overlapping provision.
So yes.
I'd like to get you to comment on that. And to refresh your memory, the comment made is that this would, because of the timing, overlap 2.0 and the changes made in 3.0. So please.
Thank you. Respond. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the issue. And just for everybody's recollection, the total nitrogen applied reporting period in Ag Order 2.0 was from September 1st through August 31st each year. And based on grower and grower advocacy comments and their wishes through the outreach process, they wanted that reporting period changed to basically a calendar year, which aligns better with their cropping. And so we made that change in the proposed order version 3.0. But seeing that today is, March 8th, I believe, March 8th, the first total nitrogen applied reports will be due a year from now, March 1st, 2018, which means then from January 1st, 2017 until today or tomorrow, growers who are not aware of this requirement and who are not sort of up to speed with what we're doing here in Ag Order 3.0, perhaps are not tracking the nitrogen that are on there, that they're putting on crops even today or for the past 2 months. We're aware of this. And we considered in the past few months whether or not we should be alerting growers. You may have to be tracking nitrogen, so do that. And what we decided is that we would inform the growers once the board made a decision about Ag Order 3.0 and this requirement. So when we receive the reports next March in 2018, we understand that there will be some growers who will not have been tracking nitrogen for these few months. We understand that. Frankly, the same thing happened in 2014. And our response was, do the best you can. And we anticipate we're going to have to do the same thing next year.
Thank you. And next, we had some other questions. So I'll start with Mayor Delgado and then Mr. Young.
All right. Thank you, Chair. Chris and Angela, Carrie ticked off a long list of management actions, grower initiatives, such as installation of backflow devices, well abandonment practices, proper pesticide handling, and many others. I couldn't write down as fast as she was listing them. So I was impressed, and looking at the anti-degradation finding 27, which addresses these sorts of BPTC lights, you know, because they're not. Anyway, how would staff object to augmenting anti-deg finding 27 to be a little more specific, to include that list that or a similar list that Carrie disclosed?
Angela Schroeder, section manager. I heard the list read by Ms. Fisher, and they do summarize the requirements that are currently in the ag order. The finding listing the different methods of treatment and control wasn't intended to be exhaustive, so I don't think it's necessary to modify that finding at this time.
So would it cause problems for staff or our board? Would it be something you'd object to?
From a technical perspective, no, but I'll leave it to Ms. Okin to talk about if there's any legal issue about address or modifying that finding.
And I know before Lori speaks that we have this issue where we don't want to go down that road of modifying all these findings. I get that. So I would hope that we would just modify a few findings, if there are a few that especially stand out. And there are a few that especially stand out. I'm not sure if this is one of them, but there's a few others I want to talk about before we're done today that we've talked about during the briefing, so no surprises for staff. But so, thank you for that.
And Mr. Young?
We were going to hear from Lori, and then I had another question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'll take a look at the list from whatever Ms. Fisher was reading. I think it's just going down the requirements of the order, so it's not really necessary to restate all the requirements that are in the order anyway. We may want to just refer to some of the provisions of the order rather than listing them. There's no problem in doing that. There are some other findings that could be made to make the anti-DEG findings a little bit more clear that we can discuss later.
Okay. And I just wanted to do this because Abby Taylor Silva mentioned it, Carrie has mentioned it, and where we can tweak our findings to be a little bit more comprehensive, a little bit more informational, it doesn't hurt. And if it's not a technical issue, I think it's something that we could consider. Because I had to leave early yesterday, and I'm sorry for that, I wasn't able to hear the Q&A that happened after Steve Shemek and others in that hour block spoke. So at some point, I'd like to ask a couple of very brief questions to staff about that presentation. But that's all I had regarding Carrie Fisher's presentation.
Yeah, I think in that regard, I would like this to be done after we have also had the public comments, and that way we don't go back to yesterday and intertwine the input and dialogue we're having currently with the speakers. So, Mr. Young.
Okay, thank you, Chair Wolf. So my question really just dovetails after your last question. That had to do with the reporting period for the nitrogen, and so kind of expanding backward in time to capture a group that is currently not incorporated into this. I'm wondering if that is really so much of an issue, and I know that we've got some growers that are going to speak, and they could address it. Certainly Mr. Costa, is going to know exactly the answer to this, but I would think that, growers, they know how much they're applying. They know how much fertilizer they're purchasing. I would think, they've got records that document these expenses, and that it's just a matter for them to go back and get their invoices out and see how much has been purchased, weight volume-wise, and to start to make the calculation for us. Do you have any knowledge of how this really impacts them? Is this information that's lost to them because they haven't been notified, sooner?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So in 2014, for those growers who were not keeping up to speed with the ag order and didn't know that this was coming, well, they essentially back-calculated, as you say. They back-calculated how much nitrogen they used on their crops. So they would take invoices of how much nitrogen they purchased and made some estimates, and they back-calculated how much nitrogen was used on each one of those crops, and that's what they did to fulfill the total nitrogen applied requirement. I agree. I don't think it's going to be a big deal, but there may be a few growers who have not tracked, haven't been tracking nitrogen applied on crops, may have to do that back calculation based on invoices for fertilizer and do it that way. Same thing happened in 2014. And as we said yesterday, for those growers who haven't been tracking it then, this is where the learning curve begins. And then the following year, then, it'll take a much less time because they've been tracking it.
So what does tracking mean?
Tracking means...
Do they enter the information off of an invoice or a purchase into a spreadsheet and track it that way?
Right. So I would have to defer to growers who have really refined this down pretty well. And I've talked to some of the consultants who have said that they have it down to, it takes them now less than an hour, about 45 minutes to do one of these forms. And so what they're doing is they're tracking how much nitrogen is applied on a specific crop, like a lettuce crop, and not calculating it off of an invoice, but rather like the concentration of the nitrogen in their fertigation water, how much water they're using, and they are calculating it as they go so that at the end of the year they can simply fill out the form.
And is that form a per crop record that's being submitted to you? That's part of the 2,000 records that you received.
Sure. Yeah, we don't. I'm sorry.
That's what you're referring to when you talk about the form that they fill out.
Yeah, what I was referring to by the form is the total nitrogen applied form, but their tracking system, that is up to them how they do that.
Well, maybe Mr. Costa can educate us when he comes up about that. Okay, thank you, Chair Wolf.
Any other question on this topic? All right, and just as a sidebar, there are also software available to perform these calculations. What I'd like to do now, before Abby, who had requested 30 minutes, this is, I think, the opportunity for a break. And let's take a 15-minute break and reconvene at 11:05. Thank you.